Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on America, B.C., when we come back. You know, 3,300 years ago, Moses instructed our forefathers. He said, "You shall not have in your bag diverse weights, a great and a small. You shall not have in your house diverse measures, a great and a small. But you shall have a perfect and a just weight. A perfect and a just measure shall you have, that your days may be lengthened in the land." That's cited from Deuteronomy 25, verses 13 through 16. Well, our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 followed that very scriptural law when they put into our federal constitution at Article 1, Section 10, these 17 words that say, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debts." But back in 1933, President Roosevelt took our gold away. And then in 1964, President Johnson took silver coin out of circulation. And in place of just weights and balances, these two presidents introduced into our current practice of the first, second, and fifth planks of the Communist Manifesto into our monetary system. They gave us Federal Reserve notes in place of gold-backed treasury bills and clad coinage in place of silver coins. Now, in the intervening 70 years or so, we Americans have gone from being the world's number one creditor nation until today we're the world's number one debtor nation. Now, who do you think were the better financial planners for our nation, Moses and our founding fathers, or Franklin D. Roosevelt and Lyndon Baines Johnson? Now, if you'd like to learn more about hard money and how to use it properly, it's another of the many lessons in our business school conducted twice a year here at the law school. To learn more, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package first? That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free. And you can call and order one right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the Mosaic Law School and our business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email, send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. America BC, written by Barry Fell. You know, when we talk about history, we think in terms of Columbus discovering America. If you're like I was when I was a little kid growing up, why, Columbus discovered America, and we have a holiday on October the 12th every year that we celebrate the discovery of America. One day, I was traveling with my wife in Illinois, and she looked over at me and she said, "Well, would you like to visit one of the pyramids here in Illinois?" And I said, "Pyramids?" And she said, "Yes, there's about 7 or 8 of them here, and not far from here, just a few miles, is one of those big pyramids." And then I said, "Well, who built it?" And she said, "Well, nobody seems to know." And I said, "Well, how big is it?" And she said, "Well, it's several hundred feet high, and it covers several acres. It's as big as the Great Pyramid of Egypt." And I was amazed. I'd never heard of such a thing. I said, "Here in Illinois, there's a pyramid?" And she said, "Yes, not just one, but 7 or 8. And I said, "Yeah, I got to see this." And so we drove off the main highway, and we drove a little while, and pretty soon here out in the middle of the flatlands of Illinois, rising on the horizon was this big hill. We drove over to the big hill. It was covered by brush and trees, and we went into the park. It's a state park, and paid our fee, and we walked in. I stood at the bottom of it, and I looked at this, and I said, "Why is it that I have been educated in America, went to the public school system, and here is a monument 400 feet high sitting in the middle of a cornfield covering about 15 or 20 acres of ground, a humongous mound of earth, and I never heard about it, and I'm 42 years old, never heard about it?" Well, it's not the only thing that I haven't heard about. It's not the only thing that you probably hadn't heard about, but have you ever heard about Egyptian hieroglyphics here in America? Have you heard about any monuments, writings, or coins found here in America that predate Columbus? How about Irish Ogham writing, Phoenician coins, Roman pottery, Norse burial mounds found in West Virginia, Georgia, Michigan, Arkansas, Illinois, Iowa, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Colorado, just to name a few places where these sites and these discoveries have been found? And then ask yourself, what did you hear when you went to school, when you went to college? Maybe you're an archaeologist or an anthropologist. Did you ever hear about America, B.C.? Well, we've heard about the Indians And we ascribe these monuments and these strange phenomena to these Indians who deny them. And when you ask the Indians of Illinois, did you or your people or any history in the past build these pyramids out here? And they'll tell you, nope, nope, we didn't build them. Do you know who did? And they'll say, nope, nope, we don't know who did. We don't know who built them. We didn't, but there they are. And they are totally ignored in the literature. I mean ignored, like they never existed. It's not the first time I've ever seen this kind of hiding the truth. We see it in politics, we see it in economics, we see it in medicine. And the truth is, we find it in science also. For instance, in March of 1493, the Catholic Church was presented with an unforeseen problem. Christopher Columbus had just landed in Lisbon after an 8-month voyage that was to have taken him to the Indies. But instead of going to the Indies, it had led him to discover a new world. And the difficulty now confronting the prelates of the Catholic Church was that he had returned with passengers, American Indians, who had all of the appearance of being human beings. But how could their existence be accounted for? The biblical account of creation described three continents, each occupied by the seed of three sons, the three sons of Noah who survived the flood, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Columbus seems already to have been aware of the impending theological problem, because in a letter dated February 15, 1493, written at the Canary Islands, he assured King Ferdinand that the people that he found were no monsters, but on the contrary, were very well formed, neither were they Negroes. And when he put ashore in Lisbon on March 6th, his journal records, many people came to see the Indians, and it was a great marvel. As the second and third and later voyages produced ever-mounting evidence of large numbers of man-like creatures inhabiting the Americas, a cold wind of skepticism began to blow through the monasteries to ruffle the equanimity of those who so boldly preached the absolute truth of Genesis. And for a time, Rome disregarded the matter, as Pope Alexander VI was otherwise engaged, save only when he found time to draw a line of demarcation between the Spanish and the Portuguese portions of the New World. But in 1512, a new pope summoned the Fifth Lateran Council and issued an official declaration certifying that American Indians are true descendants of Adam and Eve, and hence they are human beings. The failure of the Bible to account for them and to account for their continent was made good by the inference that American Indians are the descendants of Babylonians expelled from the Old World on account of sins of their ancestors. Now, backed by this new authority, it was now safe for speculative churchmen to ponder the route from the Garden of Eden to America. After considering the possibilities that Noah's Ark might have added an American port of call to her scheduled sailing plan, or that angels might have transported people across the ocean, holding them by the hair of the head, like to the prophet Habakkuk, a Spanish thinker, Jose de Acosta dismissed both propositions in favor of transportation by shipwreck and accidental tempest of the weather. Now, the inquiry was now taken up by others, and by the 17th century, both Protestant and Catholic churchmen were agreed that Asia must have been the original homeland of the American Indian forefathers, because only the rude Tartars, above all nations on earth, resemble the inhabitants of America in respect to their gross ignorance of letters and of the arts, their idolatry, and above all, their incivility. Alas, for Pocahontas, there was no Fenimore Cooper on hand to defend the Six Nations, no Deerslayer yet to win hearts or minds for the dwellers in the wilderness. One dissident, Cotton Mather in Boston, in the course of a long series of extraordinary letters to the Royal Society of London, drew attention to the existence in Connecticut of a tribe of Indians which practiced circumcision, thereby showing he thought that the American Indians should be considered as the lost tribes of Israel. Voltaire, on the other hand, considered that the American Indians had arisen de novo in America by whatever mechanism had similarly caused human beings to appear upon the face of the earth in the other continents. By 1811, such scientists as Humboldt recognized the similarities between some American tribes and those of the Mongol race, and he postulated that the American Indians are descended from a mingling of ancient Americans and later in-wanderers from Asia. Later still, most of the anthropologists came to agree that all American Indians are descended from ancestors that entered the Americas by way of the Bering Strait, and that no European came to America before Leif Erikson or Columbus. Now, in recent years, one lone voice has protested this kind of oversimplification, that of Harold Sterling Gladwin. And in his various writings, Gladwin has repeatedly drawn attention to cultural features and material objects, particularly pottery, that show that American tribes must have had relatively recent contacts with the Old World of Europe and the Middle East, especially with the Mediterranean and with the Orient. The nature of the various art styles to which he drew attention is such as to point to direct voyages between the Old World and the Americas as late as classical times, about 2,000 years ago, or about the time of Christ. Gladwin's views have, until very recently, been strictly ruled out, anathema, and they have been excluded from the college curriculum. Now, fortunately, this exclusionist attitude is now considerably ameliorated. His writings, once forbidden reading in colleges and universities in America, have now been and have become prescribed texts at places such as Harvard. Now, for generations, the archaeological world has been beset by the notion that only the navigational techniques introduced in Europe in the 15th century made it possible for Europeans to cross the Atlantic, although some grudging acquiescence is conceded to those who point to the evidence of the sagas, showing that the Viking crossings by way of Greenland, which occurred before Columbus, have been well documented. So at the time when Gladwin issued Men Out of Asia in 1947, he too felt compelled to bring the Mediterranean influence to the Americas by way of an Asian and or Indonesian land-hopping route. The vectors being supposedly the ships of the fleet of Menarchus, left stranded in Asia after the death of Alexander the Great. Well, in recent years, new discoveries in the Pacific caves have begun to lend much support to this facet of Gladwin's theories, but at the same time, the newer evidence also shows very clearly that the Atlantic was by no means the great barrier that earlier thinkers had supposed. So what, it is reasonable to ask then, is this newer evidence? Well, in fact, it is not new in and of and by itself, because it has lain intact for more than 2,000 years. All that is new is our ability to read the inscriptions concerned, because indeed, they are written, and in some sense, documents carefully engraved on the bedrock of America, on temple lintels, and on the gravestones of kings and chiefs, and they speak to us of a long-forgotten age of exploration and of colonization, which is the subject of this book. When American archaeologists first began to send me inscriptions for decipherment and translation, I was astonished to learn that such documents existed here in America. All of my earlier work had been on ancient tablets and cave inscriptions of the Old World, records of the sea peoples of the Bronze Age and early Iron Age, some 3,000 to 4,000 years ago. But what I now began to receive from unimpeachable sources here in North America were essentially the same types of documents, engraved in stone, and they were either excavated from some archaeological site, or they were recorded from cliff faces or photographed on massive rocks discovered by the early colonists. And I'd never seen such materials mentioned or illustrated in any books on archaeology of the Americas, and indeed, I was totally oblivious to their existence. How is it, I asked my friend and colleague Professor George Carter of Texas, that you are sending me all of these materials? Has no one studied them before? Well, his answer was, for 75 years I have been knocking on the study doors of professors of Greek and Latin, and each time I have been told that the objects that I had in my hand look like writing, but that it is not Greek, and that it is not Latin, nor is it any script known to my consultants. So I emerged no wiser than before. Now, the very manner in which George Carter and I were brought together is in itself instructive, because it illustrates both the difficulties now besetting communication between men working in different disciplines and the strengths of those more liberal institutions of learning that encourage their faculty to cross the lines that divide the disciplines. Carter was trained as an archaeologist at the University of California at Berkeley, but he has chosen to devote much of his life to the study of the geographical distribution of man and his domesticated plants and animals. Through his research at Johns Hopkins and then later at Texas A&M, his work became well known to biologists at Harvard, especially to botanists working on the evolution and distribution of plants cultivated by man around the world. Now, I, for my part, though a marine biologist, have spent much of my life studying the ancient voyages of people who left inscriptions on remote islands, which, of course, could only have been approached by sea. As a marine biologist, I felt obliged to examine this evidence because it would have a bearing on how the dispersal of man, plants, and animals might be influenced by ocean currents and winds. So the decipherment of these ancient inscriptions, the art of epigraphy, became my second specialty. And it was through my fellow biologists at Harvard that Carter and I were introduced to each other's work. I learned that he had amassed a fine collection of American inscriptions in the hope that their eventual decipherment might explain or illuminate his own researches, and he, for his part, now found a man who claimed to recognize the languages on his tablets. We soon found that the emerging information is consistent with our other independent investigations, and so the seal was set on a collaboration that proved very, very rewarding. When word began to appear in linguistic and archaeological periodicals of this joint effort, other archaeologists and some linguists contacted us. A flow of information now began that soon swelled to proportions far beyond anything that either George Carter or I had dreamed of. The Epigraphic Society was established, and we began to publish our findings, as well as those of others, in a form readily available to other interested people, both professional and amateur. So began the busiest and most productive period of my life, an exciting journey through space and time, bringing new friendships in a score of countries. From the information that we gleaned from the first American tablets to be deciphered, we gained important hints as to where more inscriptions might be expected to be found. So I deserted my study table and the world of dictionaries for a while to spend a wonderful summer crisscrossing the hills and valleys of the New England countryside, rejoicing whenever a terrace or ridge top yielded yet another inscribed stone. My field companions and I became deeply aware of the presence all around us of traces of a vanished civilization that had once flourished here in America. Of these New England excursions, I was most often accompanied by John Williams, a young school teacher from Connecticut, who soon made himself expert in detecting the presence of inscribed rocks beneath the soil and later carried out many exploratory trips on his own. Between the two of us, we covered some 11,000 miles on the roads and hundreds of miles on foot, clambering up hillsides or more often pushing through the woodlands that once more occupy much of the backcountry of New England. We were often joined by my wife, Renee, who occasionally made discoveries of her own. Another frequent companion was Peter J. Garfall, joined later by Joseph D. Germano, who, whenever they would spare the time, would bring their cameras to record these finds. And when the suggestion was made at one stage in one of the newspapers that we might be forging the inscriptions, it became increasingly necessary to have cameras as well as witnesses on hand to record the thick coat of lichens covering these inscriptions before they were brushed clean for making a plaster cast. Other companions from time to time were our archaeologist friends and local residents who sometimes could lead us directly to a site known to them. Now, these were long days from dawn until near midnight, but we managed to bring back to Boston a very fine series of aluminum foil impressions from which casts could be prepared on days when the weather forbade this type of fieldwork. The alphabets and languages that we found on American inscriptions are fully discussed later in this book, but the representative examples on pages 21 and 22 show how the American colonists or visitors wrote in the first millennium B.C. So let's note the similarity to corresponding examples from Europe. Now, while John Williams and I roamed the New England outback country for Celtic inscriptions, another colleague was making notable finds in the Midwest and the Southwest. This was Gloria Farley, an intrepid explorer of the cliffs and caves that border the banks of the Arkansas and the Cimarron Rivers and their tributaries. Armed with camera and snake bite anti-venom, rubber latex for making impressions, and a ladder, Gloria Farley systematically assembled a remarkable series of records of visits and settlements by European voyagers who had ascended the Mississippi River and then turned west to follow the Arkansas River, eventually to reach the Cimarron River along the border between Oklahoma and Colorado. Her discoveries showed that some Celts had followed this southern route and that Libyans and Punic-speaking Iberians and even one Basque king had ventured into the heartland of the continent centuries before Christ. Gloria Farley will be remembered for these fine contributions to our National Archives, a bright example of grit and determination in the face of discouragement on the part of those who might have helped her. On account of the skepticism and even opposition to our work that we experienced at first from some of the professional archaeologists, nearly all of the inscriptions that we first examined were ones that we discovered ourselves, John Williams and Gloria Farley being the leading explorers. Later, when our work became better understood, we began to receive valuable help from museum curators and some universities or other institutions where mysterious inscribed stones or tablets had been deposited by finders long ago. We received no financial support from any scientific fund, but through the generosity and faith of Ruth K. Hanner, the Epigraphic Society has been able to establish its own modest fund, and this, supplemented by our family budgets, has financed our travel expenses and the cost of latex and other materials needed for making copies of inscriptions that we have found cut in the rock. Those who have participated in this exploration include Malcolm Pearson, a gifted photographer who has recorded inscriptions for many years and who originally led William Goodwin to the ruins at Mystery Hill. James Whittall, architect, archaeologist, a Harvard graduate, and authority on the megalithic structures of Portugal, Spain, and of New England. Robert Stone, the curator and present owner of the Mystery Hill site in New Hampshire, which he has protected and opened to the public, and who first demonstrated the existence of an ancient astronomical observatory among the ruins in an American setting. Elizabeth Sincerebo of Vermont, who perceived the antiquity of the supposed colonial root cellars, and encouraged a young amateur astronomer, Byron Dix, to investigate what he later discovered to be calendar sites in that state. These, and others to be named in later pages, were the colleagues who now became our closest collaborators, and who, like us, had to endure much opposition. But the work was its own reward, and all of us who took part in this research agree that we lived in exciting days, and we loved every minute of them. And yet these treasures are in danger. Christopher McIntosh, an English investigator, has given an account of the ever-increasing threat of destruction of ancient sites as a result of modern highway construction and light developments. He called his 1971 report The Race to Save Britain's Past. And it often seemed to us in Vermont that we, too, are racing against time, with the added threat of vandalism. And as the months went by, I perceived a change in the attitude of my field collaborators, who seemed to become imbued with a new zest, determined to save these relics, come what may. Well, boys and girls, that's chapter 2 of America BC. It's the introduction to a wild new concept. That concept is that ancient explorers from the Middle East, the Far East, and Europe came to America by way of the Atlantic Ocean, sailed across the ocean, and had ports of call, colonies, and were digging tin, copper, and iron ore out of the Americas, loading it on ships, and hauling it back to their home ports of call. Sounds preposterous that this was going on in the days of David and Solomon, the kings of Israel, of the ancient Phoenicians, the Egyptians, the Romans, the Greeks. But yes, boys and girls, it's true. There was an America BC. Well, we'll come back and we'll look at more of America BC right after this. Let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective, 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact desk. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, America BC is written by Barry Fell. Barry Fell is a professor, he's dead now, at Harvard University. And as you see here, looking at the monuments, the Americans' oldest archives, is an 18-chapter presentation published back in 1989. It was first copyrighted in 1976, last published in 1989 by Barry Fell. You can probably get a copy at Barnes & Noble. It's pretty common today. I think the book is still in print. If you can't get it there, I'm sure that any used bookstore hooked up to the computer network can find a copy for you. It's fascinating reading. I picked up a copy. We have it here in the law school library because of a meeting that I had with one of his collaborators a lady by the name of Gloria Farley. She died just recently. Now, both of these people have been doing this for 50 years. So I'll go back 50 years and starting around 1955 or 60 or 65 or 70, these people were out in the fields. They were out in Arkansas looking at burial mounds. They were going up and down the Arkansas River looking at Hebrew and Irish Ogham writing and trying to decipher, trying to figure out where this come from. So they'd go to the Indian tribes and they'd say, well, now let's see, you Navajo Indians live here, or you Cherokee Indians lived here. Do you know anything about that? And the Indians would say, well, no, we didn't do that. That's not a part of our culture. But there it is. Well, if the Indians didn't put it there, then somebody else obviously did. As I began today's program, I said, my wife showed me a pyramid. Now, I'm going to describe this for most of you people have probably never heard of these dirt mounds. They call them the mounds out in the Midwest. They're just mounds of dirt. You know, to most people, they're just mounds of dirt. Let me describe it. I was down in Mexico City, and I went out to the ancient pyramids. There's two of them out there. One's called the Pyramid of the Moon, which was fallen down and in disarray, and the other was called the Pyramid of the Sun, which is built exactly like the Egyptian pyramids. I mean, when you look at the Pyramid of the Sun and you look at pyramids of Egypt, they're identical. They're in the dime's worth of difference between the two. And I remember as a young man looking at that Pyramid of the Sun, I said, oh my God, these people here in Central America, when they built that pyramid, one of two things had to have occurred. Number one, the Egyptians came over here and saw that pyramid and went back and built some just like it. Or these Indians went over to Egypt and saw those pyramids and came back here and built one just like it. Or somebody has been to both places and brought the technology and the design and built it over here or over there. There had to have been contact between the Aztecs and the Incas and so on in order for there to be, in this new world, monuments built on the same architectural designer plan as those in the old world. Now, we don't say that the people of Egypt came from Mexico. We say that the people of Mexico somehow got there from Europe or the Middle East. And I don't know which is which, but I presume that the human race migrated out of the Middle East and migrated all over the world. And so, of course, the story that I was told when I went to school was that Christopher Columbus was the first man to sail from Europe to the New World. And when he got here, he found these people, which then devolved upon a conversation as to how these people got here. And so the logical conclusion was that since these people did not have an advanced merchant marine, that they weren't sailing around. They had canoes, but they didn't have ships that could cross the Atlantic. Then they must have come from Asia. And when they saw these people, the Western Indians, and they saw that they had Mongol features, they said, ah, they came from Asia. Therefore, they must have crossed the Bering Straits, which is only about 50 or 75 miles. They could make it across there in canoes because we know today that the Eskimos cross from Alaska to Siberia and from Siberia to Alaska. And then somebody came up with this ancient land bridge to fit in with the theory of evolution, and presto, we have the modality by which man got to the New World. That's what I was taught in school. That's what I learned. Now I sit down and I read this book by Barry Fell and I feel like a dunderhead, like a fool. These people that came over here and built those pyramids down there in Central America had to have gotten that idea from somewhere. Now what did they do? Go back across the land bridge for thousands of years and go down to Egypt and then come up across the land bridge? If that was the case, how come nobody ever wrote about it? How come we don't see that described by the Egyptians? Hey, we went up across the land bridge, went down to Central America or wherever they wanted to call it or whatever name they hung on it, built a pyramid. Now, there's something more to the story. Something is bigger and better than what we've been told in our public school system here. And of course, then this raises another question. Why haven't we been told this? Well, one day I called home. Let me give you an example of this. One day I called home from Phoenix, Arizona, and I said to my boy Dirk, I said, have you heard about all of these shootings that are going on here in Phoenix? And he said, no. I said, do you mean that on the 6 o'clock news, that Katie Kirk, of course, and it was years ago, so it was Dan Rather, knows that, you know, Dan Rather hasn't been reporting that here in Phoenix, over a period of 16 days, there have been 14 drive-by shootings, nearly one a day, 14 people killed in 16 days? He said, not a word. Now, I thought that was pretty newsworthy. I'd never heard of such a thing. I thought, my God, you mean to tell me here in Phoenix, Arizona, people are just driving down the street, shooting people at random on street corners, and that doesn't make national news? Now, the other day, 30 people were killed in a college campus. 7 or 8 people were killed at Columbine. That made national news for days on end. I thought 16 people getting killed on the streets of Phoenix in 14 days in a two-week period, I thought that would make national news. Here's another example. I was out in Colorado years back, you know, I don't know, 20 years ago probably, 15. I picked up the Denver Post, and there had been 154 banks closed by the Federal Reserve in Colorado. I said, oh, my God, 154 banks in Colorado closed all the same day. I called home. I said, Dirk, what's going on in the news? He said, what news? I said, 154 banks have been closed here in Colorado. He said, never heard of it. I said, you haven't heard that 154 banks, you know, to my mind, I said, I haven't heard of anything like this since the Great Depression, since March 5th of 1933, when President Roosevelt closed the banks. He said, no, sir, no, sir, not a thing on the news. I've been watching McNeil there, I've been watching Dan, and Tom Brokaw hadn't said a word. So it set off in my mind, you know, this old concept that we had been taught when I went to school, and that is, the Russians are deceived by their press. They have a managed and a controlled news media. We all knew that because we went to public school over here in the United States. But here in the United States, our news media is free. And because our news media is free, we get a free flow of information from all over the world. And so when something happens in a remote part of the world like Uganda, the Associated Press, Reuters, and the United Press are there to cover it. They send the information back to New York. New York, in turn, sends it out across America, and the newspapers and the news media and the local hamlets report on these events. Now, I thought 154 bank closings in a single day in Colorado was pretty newsworthy. And I thought 14 people being murdered on the streets of Phoenix was pretty newsworthy. You'd have thought that somebody somewhere would have picked up on it. They didn't. So it sent me a signal, and it said the news media of America is just as controlled as the news media in Russia. Now, that's a wild new concept for most of you people out there, but that was the conclusion that I came to. And it has been reinforced over the years. It's reinforced because here at the law school, we have access to the news wires. We get news not only from Reuters and UPI and AP and CBS and, you know, all the main sources of news that go on around the world, but we also subscribe to a number of newsletters called the Underground Press. The Underground Press. There are about 600 of these newsletters around the United States. These newsletters that I report to you from time to time, from Mogambo, for instance, or the International Forecaster. In one case, we cite from time to time from The Privateer, published in Queensland, Australia. Or we may be citing from newsletters that are published in Switzerland or Germany. It's what we call the Underground Press. And they tell us what's going on in the economies, what's going on in the news, what's going on in Iraq and Iran and so on, that you don't hear over the news media. So from our perspective here at the law school, we come to the conclusion, we believe here that the news in America is as controlled as is Pravda and Izvestia in Russia. It isn't that the information isn't available or that it didn't happen. It's that it's not reported. Now, here's an example. Let's suppose that we have a big news event. And the government wants us to know about it. Boy, do we hear about it. For instance, the other day, a young fellow was getting married. He was from Georgia, and he wanted to get married in Italy. He's a lawyer. His father-in-law is a scientist at the CDC, so these people, you know, are probably upper middle class or maybe even lower wealthy, rich class people. But most of us down here at the bottom tiers where I'm at here in Isabella, Missouri, you know, hillbillies, we don't just jump on an airliner and fly to Italy or to Greece and to have a wedding out on a remote island. You know, most of us here, you know, we're shacked up with Bessie Ballmortal down here, and we get married at the end of a shotgun over here at Preacher Smith. But this fella, he had a little money, and so he jumps on an airliner, and he rushes over to Italy, and then over to Greece, he gets married. Then he jumps on an airliner, rushes up to Prague, jumps on another airliner, goes over to London, jumps on another airliner to Montreal, rents a car, and drives into the United States. Now, you probably heard about this guy. This guy. He has tuberculosis. Now, they assure us that it's not highly contagious, but the surprising part of this was, this one man has a disease, TB. And the thing that surprised me was that one-third of the people of the world are carrying TB bacteria in their body. One-third. That's one person out of every three on planet Earth has TB. This guy's got TB. The conclusion is that he's not highly contagious, and therefore he wasn't much of a threat. He was on the no-fly list. They were supposed to apprehend him, and they didn't. This guy is on an airplane. If this guy had Ebola, had he been in Uganda and picked up Ebola or Lassa fever, something that's really highly contagious, then maybe you've seen some of the disaster movies. He gets on an airliner and infects 200 people. Those 200 people go out into their 200 different communities and infect 200 people, and pretty soon you have this worldwide epidemic, this worldwide pandemic that kills millions of people. You've been to the movies like I have. You know how that story works. And then the government, what do they always do? They try to calm the public by quashing the story. Hell, they don't want you to know about it. But in this case, one man has TB that isn't even infectious. He flies around the world, comes back, and oh my God, this guy is a threat to the health, safety, and welfare of the people of the world. Well, that's because we got this war on terror, and because the government wanted us to know about that one case. They publicized it. I mean, it was publicized, at least here in the United States. I can't speak for you people around the world now, but here in the United States, it was in the news day after day after day for about a week. He didn't kill anybody. Nobody was infected. Nobody. It was a tempest in a teapot. It was a non-event. But boy, did they've got Senate hearings on this guy. How in the hell could he get on an airplane and get into the United States with TB? Now, let's carry this a step further, and let's suppose we wanted to quash, like the Catholic Church at the beginning of chapter 2 says, we got a problem here. You remember the story about Galileo? Galileo, you know, discovered the telescope, or at least, you know, at least he reinvented it or did something. He takes a look here in the heavens. He's a pretty smart guy. He's an Italian, you know, pretty smart guy. And he's peering around in the stars and one thing and another, and he comes up with an idea. He says, you know, the common concept is that the sun is circling the earth. And boys and girls, that makes all the sense in the world, you know, because I get up in the morning and I see the sun come up in the east, and I'm watching here as I'm milking the cows at night, and I see the sun go down in the west. And I would just look at that and say, well, the sun comes up over there and it goes down over there, so therefore the sun must be circling around the earth. That's the obvious conclusion that you would come to. And I think mankind, just looking at the physical evidence that they were looking at, would come to that conclusion. The idea that the earth is circling around the sun every 365 days doesn't enter our minds through our five senses. And the idea that the earth is spinning on its axis, you know, at 1,000 miles an hour, and it's 25,000 miles in diameter, and that's why we have 24 hours in a day, you know, that isn't something that we perceive in our five senses. But Galileo, with his telescope, with his, you know, with his above average intelligence, probably, you know, 100, 110, something like that, a little higher than the average hillbilly, you know, around 75 or 80, we test out pretty low here in the Ozarks, but, you know, giving Galileo the benefit of the doubt, hell, maybe 120. He's dinking around over here. Now, he's a Catholic. So he's a Catholic. This is back in the Middle Ages. He comes to a conclusion. Maybe his conclusion is totally erroneous. But anyway, he's got this idea. He comes out and he says, hey, listen, I think that the earth is rotating on its axis and spinning out around the sun over here. He comes up with a model and he rewrites it all out. And he says, hey, this is the way I see this. And right away, this runs counter to theology. It runs counter to the church teachings. And so they came to him one day and they said, hey, listen, you're a heretic. And what we're going to do is take you out and kill you, burn you at the stake over here so that we can protect you, save your soul from hell, and all the rest of the people that might be listening to you. The Catholic Church has always been a pioneer in free speech, haven't they? And new ideas and scientific technology. You know, you can just look to the Catholic Church for breaking new ground, can't you? Well, anyway, that was the story. And so they came to him and they said, now you go out here and you tell these people that all of this is a bunch of hooey and that you lied about it. And so he did. He went out, you know, under threat of being killed. You know, he said, well, yeah, it's all a bunch of hooey and it's not true. And the sun revolves around the earth. And then when he was walking out of the theater, he said, well, the truth of the matter is the earth revolves around the sun nevertheless. Boys and girls, the truth is the truth, and nevertheless, it doesn't make any difference whether every archaeologist in America says Columbus discovered America. Taint so. As evidenced by the fact when the guy set foot here in the New World, there were already people here. So it's pretty obvious that they discovered America first. Columbus did a valuable service for the Europeans. There's no doubt about it. The modern discovery, that is, in 1492 of the Americas, was a big step forward. I don't deny it. But we wanted to know, well, what about all these monuments over here? And when you find these monuments all over America, and I started out by saying, we have found monuments, writing, and coins. We have found Egyptian hieroglyphics. We have found Irish Ogham writing. We have found Phoenician coins. We have found Roman pottery. We have found Norse burial mounds. And we have found all of these things in these states. Not just limited to these states, but at least in West Virginia, Georgia, Michigan, Arkansas, Illinois, Iowa, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Colorado. There have been some 3,000 finds. That's 3,000. Did you get that number? 3,000 finds nationwide here in the United States of America. There's more in Canada. There's more in Mexico. There's more in Brazil and in Central America than there is here in the United States. But, the fact that there are 3,000 of these finds here in the United States ought to tell you something. And yet the field of archaeology totally ignores it. In fact, it's worse than ignorance and ignoring. They actually attack those who would come to you and say that there were European, Middle Eastern, and Asiatic explorers, settlers, and colonists in the United States of America before Christ was born. And they get vehement, very vehement. And so, of course, the question arises, well, why? Why? I mean, archaeologists today come out of our academic process fully aware of Galileo and the Catholic Church, who used to teach that the earth was round. Oh, excuse me. I forgot. Oh, yeah, the Catholic Church used to teach the earth was flat. Do you remember that when you went to school? They used to teach that the sun revolved around the earth. Do you remember that? That's theology. Now, we got to forgive those guys because they're religious. What in the hell is the story behind the archaeologists that come out of our universities and colleges today telling us that Columbus discovered America? And then they ignore 3,000 archaeological sites here in the United States with Egyptian hieroglyphics. Wouldn't somebody that comes out of, let's say, archaeology school in California, Illinois, and New York, just pick those three states, any school, any college, any University of Illinois, University of New York, University of California, wouldn't you think that two or three of those guys would come out and say, what in the hell is this Egyptian hieroglyphics in Colorado or New Mexico or Georgia? You know, you just think that somebody would. Now, there's a reason why we don't, and the answer to that is very simple. It's political. It is politically incorrect for you to believe in creation and God. It is politically correct to believe in evolution. And if you're a college professor like Immanuel Velikovsky, who wrote a book called Worlds in Collision and Ages in Chaos, he wrote two. If you're a college professor like Velikovsky, you will be disbarred. You will lose your tenure. That's what happened to Velikovsky. If you were to suggest that something is different than the politically accepted correct party line. Now in Russia, we used to laugh. People were fired from their jobs because they weren't a member of the Communist Party or they didn't espouse the official communist line. Boys and girls, that's the way it works here in America. Here in the United States of America, if you're a whistleblower in government, you will probably be fired. And if you manage to keep your job, you will be buried so deep in the bureaucracy in a cubbyhole, buried in the Pentagon somewhere, nobody will ever know you work there. That's if you tell the truth. If you're a college professor and you tell the truth about archaeology, paleontology, or any scientific study, you will lose your tenure at that college. And you know it, and I know it. From time to time, I recite a story that comes from a fellow by the name of John Swinton. He was in the journalist profession, and he said, there's no such thing at this date of world history in America as an independent press. You know it, and I know it. He said, there's not one of you dares write an honest opinion, and if you did, you know beforehand it would never appear in print, and I'm paid weekly. Now, this is a journalist. This is an editor of a newspaper. He said, I'm paid weekly for keeping my honest opinions out of the paper that I'm connected with, and others of you are paid for similar things, and any of you who would be so foolish as to write your honest opinions would be out on the streets looking for another job. And any of you college professors out there that spoke your honest opinions in the institution that you're employed by, you'd be out on the streets. And that's why you lie to your students, and you lie to them daily. John Swinton said, we are intellectual prostitutes. Well, that's the beginning of America BC by Barry Fell. I'm out of time. I got to give you a final reminder here that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School at Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Remember, The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, we're about out of time. We're going to have to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course, until then. Thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.